Welcome to Conversations About Running, the podcast from Running Trips. I'm Gavin Smith, and in today's episode, Callum and I are joined by Amelia Goretzka. Amelia is a double European junior champion over cross country, European junior champion and world junior bronze medalist on the track over 3,000 metres. Her 5,000 metre PB is 15.07. In a wide-ranging and insightful episode, Amelia talks to us today about her success in athletics from a young age, the realities of signing a professional athlete contract as a 16-year-old, and allows us a unique insight into her early retirement from the sport. Amelia shares with us the reasons behind her retirement from athletics in her mid-20s, and explains why closing that chapter of her life is not a sob story and shouldn't be viewed as a negative experience. We discuss Amelia's career in detail, as well as her continued involvement in the running world through her new career with the innovative running footwear brand On. Thanks to Amelia for joining us, and we hope you enjoy our conversation with today's guest, Amelia Goretzka. Right, today we are very lucky to be joined by Amelia I don't know how to say her name. That's not a good start. Let's start by Amelia. Could you please introduce yourself?
Hi, my name's Amelia Goretzka, but I like the way that you admitted that you didn't know how to say my name, because some people try and fail. So
I see. I think if I'd have just gone for it, I think I'd have said it pretty close. I'd have said Goretzka.
Yeah, that's but how the British say it, which is absolutely fine.
So how would you pronounce it? Yeah, like so what did you do there? You gave us the British version, or?
So it's Polish. It's European origin, and it's pronounced Goretzka as if there's an S or an X in there. So yeah, I don't blame the British for pronouncing it the way it's spelt. But yeah, while we're at it, that's how you pronounce my name.
So how many different variations have you heard sort of throughout your running career?
Gorka has been one of them, which really
that's an odd one. I can't see that.
Happens is people, and particularly even with Amelia, which is my first name, they read the first two letters and then they get lazy and just call me Emily, as if like they can't be bothered to finish off the word. So I've been called Emily Gorka, Gorika. Goreka's pretty standard, but that's just how it looks.
Goreka's like almost acceptable. I mean, I know it's not actually your name, but it's like, you know, I could see why people would say that, but Gorka is just
it's lazy. Yeah, it's pure laziness.
So my wife is her family heritage is Latvian.
Okay.
And yeah, the English version is Lycetis.
Right.
But if I try to do the Latvian version, Lycius. but then if Lauren's dad says it, I can't even recognize the word from what's written down.
So yeah,
it's surprising how much.
It's phonetics as well, isn't there? And there's an accent in my name as well, which I don't talk about much because, again, that confuses people. So, like, it's just a culture thing. If I was in a European country right now, they would look at it and just pronounce it naturally straight away. And when I used to race abroad, when people would cheer for me, it was really weird because they would, like, cheer the correct name, which was nice as well. but I'm just used to people calling me, you know, by the British pronunciation, but it's fine. It's a good intro, isn't it, actually, to get that one done. And I don't expect people to remember
it already now, so
that's all right. I'm not offended. It's my dad that will get offended. He's the Polish one, really.
Right.
So, sorry, Jim.
So Amelia, so as you've mentioned work a few times, I mean, let's go in that direction, at least initially, because so I know you kind of, sorry, not personally, but I know you as a super elite runner. Who kind of all of a sudden I haven't noticed your name in results for a while. So we can kind of backtrack and go down there in a while, but like what is your situation at the moment?
So I'm working for On Running. I'm part of the UK team and I am a technical representative alongside Callum. We're very new. We started about 2 months ago and it's so much fun. We've like had the best time. And it wasn't where I saw myself going in terms of careers, to be honest. But that's the journey I've been on, and I've kind of learned over the past few years to let go, not have any expectations about where I'm going to go next. And actually, it's turned out to be, you know, I'm in the best place now. I'm really enjoying what I'm doing. And I just didn't think I'd be here.
Yeah. So can you
Can you kind of elaborate on that? Because there's going to be people out there listening now who are kind of thinking, what are they talking about?
Yeah, so obviously I've come from an athlete background. I was an elite athlete from the age of 16 years old with Nike. And I had a career, I'd say, for about 9 years. When I got to the age of 25, I retired. I retired and quit. I stopped. I'm happy to use any of those terms.
Yeah, see, I think you're genuinely at a level where you kind of hit that retire. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Sometimes when people do quit, like if I stopped running, I've quit.
Mm, yeah.
But no, I do think you're at that boundary where, yeah, stopping does equal retirement. So, I mean, were you technically a professional athlete?
Yeah, so I had a Nike contract from the age of 16. So that meant that I was paid every 6 months. I had an annual base retainer that I would earn, and then bonuses that I'd accumulate from that, depending on how I performed that year. And that was from the age of 16 all the way up until the age of 25, 26. So yeah, I use the word retired, but I'm not, I think people get a little bit scared of using the word quit because it seems like quite a negative term, but I'm more than happy to use that as well because it was very much a decision and something that I'm proud of as well. So it was quite abrupt. It was very early in terms of an athlete career, because as a long distance athlete, you'd assume somebody who's got sponsorship and backing and ability to kind of carry on into their late 20s and early 30s, which is something that I didn't decide to do. And it came down to primarily a choice, but I also had some health problems at the time, and it's something that I'm very comfortable with, and I don't think it's talked about enough, like stopping and actually it being okay. And I think I've had this chat with Callum as well, and I'm happy to talk about it with anyone, that when an athlete quits, stops, retires, it doesn't always have to be a sob story. It's something that actually should be an open conversation, and it's something, like I said, I'm quite proud of. And you shouldn't always get the violin out, and it shouldn't always be the end of the world, because it's more.
I think we had a little chat with one of the people you spoke to after having retired, was Jake Whiteman, and it was so refreshing to speak to him, because he said something a bit different to everyone else, which was basically just like pretty much well done, and like how's life now, what's going on now. Rather than like digging into reasons why you retired, and I think you said something like, it was just so refreshing to hear someone ask, you know, about the positives of that rather than focusing on any potential negatives.
Yeah, definitely. And Jake won't remember this at all, but I spoke to him at Highgate, I think, in 2019, when I was in the middle of pretty much quitting and stepping back, and he had just come back from running something insane at a Diamond League, you know, very much. Or he still is in the peak of his career. And we just got chatting at Highgate, and he said, well, what are you doing now? And I said, oh, I'm a special needs assistant at primary school, really enjoying it, something quite different. And he just seemed so interested in that rather than focusing on the fact that I wasn't running. There wasn't a, oh, I'm so sorry to hear, poor you, kind of tone to him. And it was so refreshing, but unfortunately that's quite rare to receive from people.
How do you feel then when you do see, say you do see someone that you haven't seen in a while, or just someone who you kind of vaguely know, and they do have that reaction, and they find out that you're not running, and they immediately give you sympathy?
I just smile. I'm my usual self. I tell them what I'm up to, what I'm enjoying, say that it's okay, because there's not a part of my career that I regret. I don't look back and regret anything. And all you can do is just convey where you're at now. And sometimes when somebody's expressing their sorrow for you, it's usually a reflection of how they would feel if it was them rather than.
Completely.
Yeah. So it's not personal at all. It's more, I think if this was to happen to you, perhaps you'd feel different, but that's okay. I can't change the way that you would feel, but no, it's great. This is what I'm doing. And how are you? And you just carry on the conversation as normal. But I have definitely noticed I get more of the I'm so sorry than congratulations, well done. Mm. And that's a topic that I'm very passionate about, is, you know, you can congratulate someone for making a tough decision and putting themselves first. That's amazing. And unfortunately, it doesn't quite happen that way in the world of sport, because you're expected to continue regardless.
So Amelia, I'm just trying to kind of get my own head around sort of the position you're in, but I'm still, as someone who doesn't know this story that you're hopefully going to kind of elaborate a little bit on, like, I'm still sat here thinking, okay, so why isn't she running? Like, I don't really, is that something you're happy to go into?
Oh yeah. Just tell me when to stop, to be honest.
Okay. Yeah. So, maybe if you could just say, like, then we're talking about the fact that you stopped running, you've moved on with your life and you're in a great place and you're really proud of what you achieved in your career. But yeah, can you then just give us a little bit of insight then into why that career has stopped at a relatively early age?
Yeah, of course. And if you want to get a bit more detailed, then just obviously interrupt me. I was training under Chris Thompson, who was my coach at the time. And I'm still in close contact with him and his wife, Gemma Simpson. And I'm actually really close to them to this day. And I would call them my adoptive parents. So there's still such a good relationship there between us. But I went through a phase at the beginning of 2018, all the way through to 2019, of poor health. I experienced a lot of upper respiratory tract infections, tonsillitis, viruses. I did, somewhere in the midst of that, test positive for glandular fever, although with the test results, you can't quite pinpoint when that was. I'm assuming it was in somewhere that period, but I'll never know. All that I do know is I had quite a lot of symptoms. I had lightheadedness throughout that period of time, which affected me not just when I was running, but day to day. So I would be talking to my friend and I'd say, I've got severe brain fog right now and I'm not quite with it. And it was accumulative throughout that year. And it got to the point in 2019 where I just decided one day to stop running. And it sounds quite abrupt. It obviously took a lot to get to that point. The team that I was working with were so supportive. We'd done a lot of investigations with blood work, and there was a lot of different things off with my results there as well. And I just woke up one morning and I said, I'm just not going to run for this moment in time. I really want to just ground myself and give my body time. Whatever's going on is obviously, it's more than just the odd cold, given the symptoms I was experiencing. And everyone was so respectful of that.
At that moment in time, when you kind of made that decision almost that day, was that at that moment, had you decided, I'm not going to run today, I'm not going to run for a week, I'm not going to run for a month? Or was that almost like, I think this is probably it for my running, full stop?
It was, if I don't want to run today, I won't. And it was very much in the moment. So the conversation that I had with people is, I'm not running right now, I don't want to. Usually the theme with runners is that when they've got an injury or an illness, they're so eager to get back and they're so eager to recover and plan their way back into the sport. And I didn't feel that way at all. My feeling was very much, I want to step back and I want to put myself first and my health first and give myself that space. And that wasn't labeling anything at that point. I wasn't calling it retirement. I was being in the moment and being really honest with my team and saying, today I don't want to run. And today I want to be myself and do other things and put my well-being first. So the decision to initially quit, I guess, was driven by the fact that I wanted to give my body time, no matter what that meant. And I didn't know what that would mean long term at all. And then it did get to the point where symptoms were passing, particularly the lightheadedness, and I think that was also related to some hormonal imbalances that I was experiencing at the time. And I still didn't want to get back into it, which is where it became more of a choice. And it became, this is probably a long-term decision now, and I'm going to stick with it and just go by what feels right, not what potentially might be expected of me outside of my own well-being. But I'm very lucky and grateful that everyone around me supported that. There was no pressure whatsoever, and it became quite a natural decision for me, which is why it's something that I celebrate, because I put myself first, and you can't have any regrets when you do that.
So even though there were health issues which kind of led you to come to this decision, it sounds as if this is still actually, it was your decision to, like, it was your, what's the wording for it? Like, this wasn't forced upon you. It wasn't, I can't run and I'm desperate to run. It was more a case of, I'm now in a position of my life where that is no longer a priority for me.
Oh yeah, 100%. Yeah, right. You've hit the nail on the head. I mean, people will say to me, do you miss it? And throughout, I'd say no. I had friends that, and I still have friends that are very much in the sport, and I support them. I go on the bike with them. I try and run with them when I can. And there's not a part of me that gets itchy and says, I want to be back part of that. In that way, and there's no bad feeling towards, you know, that world. I just don't feel that yearn to get back into it, and I never did, and that's why it became such a strong decision for me, and it was so natural, and it was like a gut instinct and something that I couldn't explain to other people, because a lot of other runners just would say, well, why don't you want to? And it is quite an addictive sport, isn't it? People love getting out.
Do you think part of that is that you did achieve so much whilst you were running that it kind of feels like a closed chapter? Or were there still goals that were ahead of you?
I mean, there's always going to be. So I remember running with Chris Thompson many times I ran with him, but there's one particular occasion he said to me, you know, no matter when you retire, you're just never going to be happy or satisfied. And that's something that you have to come to terms with as an athlete, is that there's always going to be things that you wish you had achieved or addressed or gone for. And you have to be happy whenever your time's up, whether it's a choice or not. You have to have peace with that. So again, I found peace with that quite quickly. I remember speaking to people and saying, I'll never know how good I could have been or whether that was it, because I never carried on, and I'm okay with that decision. For example, I'm not an Olympian. I was quite young still, managed to get myself into a place where I was ready within that Olympic year. And I'm okay with that. I mean, it doesn't keep me up at night. I never got to wear the carbon shoes. I still haven't worn a carbon shoe. I don't know what
my
time's.
Do it.
Do you know what? I said to Callum, I'm going to get a carbon shoe and I'm going to do a park run and just see what the fuss is about, because I have no idea what people are talking about right now.
I reckon you'd actually break your 5k PB right now.
You know where my fitness is at. It's not good, Callum.
You'd sub 15, I reckon.
Imagine.
What was 5k PB, Amelia?
15:07.
Yeah, that's fast, isn't it? 15:07. where did you run that?
Stanford. And I was, that's 2014, and I was 20 years old. So I probably wore like a pair of Victories or something back then.
So just diverting a little bit then, as you mentioned the Olympics, so how close were you then to making the 2016 team you're in that kind of shape?
Oh no, I was not running much then at all, because I was recovering from a stress fracture.
Okay.
So yeah, in 2015 I got my first and only ever injury. I got two stress fractures within that year, and that's it in my career. But
that surprises me a little bit. Again, like, as someone who is just a fan of the sport and kind of knows you as someone who just follows running, I thought this is why you stopped running. I thought you stopped running because of injury issues related to your back. where have I got that wrong impression from?
No idea.
Have I completely made something up? Or?
Well, I have spoken about my back a lot in the past, which is another part of myself that I'm pretty proud of. Like, I've got scoliosis and I wore a body brace for 3 years to stabilize that. That was a big part of my life. I've definitely spoken about it.
I think, and I could be completely off the mark here, but I think other people might have the same impression. I thought when you kind of, I know this isn't what happened, but when you disappeared from the scene, I had presumed that that was due to injury. Well, I'm kind of repeating what I just said, but yeah, I when you say you've only had two injuries, both stress fractures, and in that same calendar year, I think as an outsider, I thought that was maybe the start of kind of like the problems, and that the problems were, I know they were physical, but they were physical from kind of pain and injury point of view rather than health and illness point of view. And yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that's just because I'd seen things about the scoliosis and kind of you kind of fill in an incomplete picture. You go, okay, she's got this situation with her back. She's had stress fractures. Now I haven't seen any race results. And you kind of fill in the blanks for yourself. So it's just really interesting to hear that wasn't the case. But are you able to kind of talk a little bit more about the back and about the scoliosis and kind of what... how did you manage that? Did it affect your running in a significant way? And
yeah,
is there anything you can share around that?
Yeah, I guess. So just touching upon what you said, that again is the typical stereotype that people assume, isn't it? That, you know, they're not running anymore. It must be something injury related. It must be something.
Yeah, it must be a bad thing. It must be a bad,
It must be terrible. And I'm so sorry to hear. And that's why people don't reach out as well, because, that was another thing that I noticed, is that not many people got in contact to see how I was, because I think a lot of people assumed it's not good she's not happy. But anyway, the scoliosis, that's going back so far now. So I have scoliosis, which means I've got a curved spine. It means I've got muscular rotation on my back, and I naturally have certain ways of sitting, and my posture is very much twisted. So I was diagnosed when I was 12 years old, when I fell over in a running session, and my physio just found it. She just looked at my back just to check after I'd fallen over if I was okay. And she said to my dad, "Do you realize that her spine does this?" In which we just all looked at each other and went, "Well, no." And it's something that is more prominent in adolescent girls. As you go through your growth spurt, it becomes more pronounced, and mine is very much genetic. So it's not something that running created. It's not from training too much or anything. It's something that my grandmother passed down to me. She also passed me down a bunion as well, which is great.
She's got a lot to answer for, isn't she?
Honestly, I'm like a gene pool of deformity.
There must be some good in there as well, though. I'm not letting you get away with that.
No, it's fine.
I'm sure you trained hard and were dedicated and all the rest of it, but there must be something in there to run 15:07 at 20 years old.
Yeah, for sure. And like, honestly, I wouldn't change anything. Like I've said, best character building. So when your spine gets to a point where either you're developing and it is getting worse, so it got worse from the age of 12, the choice was to either be put into a body brace, which is a plastic corset that gets, you know, molded to your body, and you have to wear that for 23 hours a day, or you have surgery later on. So the decision was to get put into that body brace. I named it Brian because I needed it to be a friend.
Is that a friendly name to you, is it?
I don't know. Brian the body brace. It sounds quite good, no?
I don't know. Don't know any Brians, so I can't.
The next TV show after Bob the Builder, next on CBBC is Brian the body brace.
Well, it had a sequel because I obviously grew and I had to get a new one made. And I called that Brian the Second. So
imaginative.
Exactly. Thank you. And yeah, you've got to like become familiar and like almost like a friend with this thing, because you're a teenager. It's a weird part of your life where you want to be really cool, and then
you need to do that with the treadmill, Cal. How am I going to become friends with the treadmill?
Terry the treadmill.
Terry, yeah. All right, Tezza.
Yeah.
So yeah, I had that or Brian with me for 3 years, and that hour that I was allowed out of it every day, I trained. And obviously washed and all of that. Really important. And that was huge character building. And obviously looking at my results throughout those years, it didn't stop me like achieving what I wanted to achieve. And perhaps later on, like there were complications further down the line. And I think actually, Callum, you guys wanted to speak about this as well. I started working with Mark Buckingham in my early 20s, and he's an amazing physio. I don't know if any of you guys have seen him before.
Yeah,
so,
Gavin.
So, Amelia, have you ever had a situation where, like, it's enough to do with running, but just
right.
when you kind of see someone and you think, oh, I know that person, and then you can't work out why you know them, and it's sort of a tiny bit awkward.
Right.
And you're like, do you know what I mean? Like, you're like, oh, do I know that person? Like, maybe yeah. it's an old friend. Right, okay, so one time I came out of Mark's room. This is pre-COVID. Oh, I don't know, you probably haven't been there since COVID if you're not running anymore.
But yeah.
like, so they don't have a waiting room anymore. You wait in your car until the physio comes out to get you.
Okay.
So I came out of Mark's room, walked into reception, kind of went to the desk to pay, and just sort of looked across and just thought, shit, I know her. And I was, and you gave the game away. And I thought, oh crap, this is awkward because I know that person, but I can't think who it is or why I know them or who they are.
Mm.
And then you kind of like looked up to go, and you were basically, Mark called you in to go to your room, and kind of like and you were with Gemma. And as you went in with Gemma for the appointment after me, I suddenly thought, it's Amelia Goretzka and Gemma Simpson. And I've never met either of them. That's why I kind of felt like who is that person? Who is that? Oh, yeah, that's fine. I don't know them. I just.
Yeah.
Yeah. Seen her on telly at the European Championships and.
Oh, can I just say, you got my name spot on there.
Yes.
That was so good. Obviously you didn't quite click who I was, but always say hi. Yeah, love that. But I get that.
Yeah.
I always, I'm like that with people. I was like that the other day at work, actually, Callum at the squad race. Somebody spoke to me and I was like, oh, I know who you are. And it's so awkward and I don't like it. So I get you.
You had a few of them at London Marathon as well, didn't you, at the expo?
Yeah.
I know who you are. Not as many as Ben is running, though.
No, I didn't get up to his level, unfortunately. So you've seen Mark before then?
Yeah. I guess you'd say more times than you'd like to. But yeah, I mean, it's not really true because, yeah, he's a fantastic physio. And yeah, he's kept me running throughout the years. It's an interesting one because in one respect, it's great to have a great relationship with your physio. But on the other hand, it's like, I wish I didn't need to come here so often.
Yeah, but you get, like, because he's so good. I mean, the conversation I'd always had with Chris and Jen was like, oh, imagine if I saw him every week. Like,
I literally had that conversation. Yeah, and I said, if I could just go in every Monday, I'm sure I'd just never be injured.
Yeah, I'd be, like, amazing.
I don't know if that's true or not, and you kind of get dependencies and things, but yeah.
Amelia, didn't you say he gave you, like, it was like an intercostal rib, like, treatment.
Yeah.
Horrific.
So I want to hear about that.
Yeah, I mean, so basically working with Mark came from the relationship I had with Chris and Jem. We agreed that was a setup I wanted to go down when I started getting coached by them in my early 20s. So when I went to go and see Mark, in my eyes, I'm just fine. And I would sit there and be like, no, absolutely fine. You know, just check me over, see what you think. And he started looking at me and he was like, oh my God. He's like, oh, I don't know what's going on here. Basically, because I had the body brace for 3.5 years and the scoliosis, to me, I know nothing different. My body is absolutely fine. I can't compare it to anyone else's. It feels normal to me. But when he started looking at my back, if you think about being in a body brace basically 24 hours a day for 3 years of your life while you're developing as a teenager, the restriction that has on your development from the rib cage down is it's very restrictive. And basically he looked at the rib cage down and said, I don't think you use the lower third of your lungs. And I think a lot of the intercostal muscles around your rib cage are stuck. And it was gristly, it was horrible. And he made me scream and swear and everything. It was brilliant because once he went in, he would open me up and I could suddenly breathe a bit better again and my rib cage could expand. But it was a long going process. And at some point, actually, just from a personal perspective, I'd go back again and get more treatment from him just from a maintenance health side of things.
Is that the most pain you've ever been in that little office?
Awful. Absolutely hideous.
The most, the single most painful experience of my life has been in that room.
Yeah, and he puts his body weight onto you. Like my mum's got a picture of him on me with his fingers in between the rib cage, and she's there thinking, is this normal? And she took pictures because she just wasn't sure, bless her. And I'm sweating and not crying, but kind of making sounds as if I'm crying and swearing, because Mark's great. He's like, swear. He's like, I don't take offense to what you're going to say to me. I'm just going to do what I need to do. And he's physically on top of me with his fingers in between the rib cage, and that's not a big space at all. It was brutal, absolutely brutal. But his aim and our aim as a team was to get my rib cage opening up so I could try and use the lower third of my lungs that I think was very much neglected. And if you've ever run with me, people will still to this day say that I sound a bit like a dog. I pant like a dog. I always did, because if you think about, if I don't use the lower third, it's the, I'm a chesty breather. I breathe, you know, from the chest up, and that sounds like a dog. So his job was to open up everything else, which was horrific.
So I'll tell you about mine in a minute. My pain in Mark's office, but I've also been there with athletes who I've been coaching, and it is kind of funny, like when you're not on the receiving ends. So one of the guys I was coaching with just had not even that bad of a calf problem, but he was lying on the bed. I'm just sat on the chair at the side of the office, and Mark's has got his elbow deep in there, and I'll just use his name. And Chris was lying on the bed, like, you know, he's sort of a gruff northerner, and he just, you know, doesn't like showing emotion, and his face is just going redder and redder and redder, and he's like,
Mark won't stop. Like, no matter how much you're in pain, he doesn't care. It's like he's immune to it.
I've asked him before. I've said, Mark, it's too much, and he's just basically given me a countdown. He's gone 30 seconds.
He's good, but
that is a long time as well
when you're already at your limit. It's a long time. So my most painful, has he ever used, I just call it the tool. I don't know what it is really. It's just like a little, it's just plastic. It's not even metal, but it's like a plastic.
Yeah.
And it's got a sharp edge basically, so that he can get into deep, small bits.
Yeah. Like, awful.
Like a scraper.
Actually.
Yeah, it's like a scraper. Yeah. So I had a problem, and we initially thought, well, before I saw Mark, I thought I had an Achilles injury. Mm. We were trying to manage it as an Achilles injury, and wasn't really happening. And then when I got in with Mark, what had actually happened was which apparently isn't that unusual, but the physio I was seeing hadn't sort of come across it. My plantaris tendon had fused to my Achilles tendon.
Oh.
Yeah. So Mark's job was literally to separate two tendons that had fused isn't quite the right word, but kind of like latched together.
Mm.
And, oh my word. I mean, Achilles are sensitive areas anyway. So now I've got, this sharp plastic tool, and he's still using, I think the reason he's using that is because his body weight wasn't enough force already.
Oh, bless you. Do you know what? My palms are actually sweating from like listening to that, because it's traumatizing. And like, the thing is, oh God.
Everyone's had he is an amazing physio, and he can just see things and treat things and just figure things out in a way that I think not many people are able to do, but it does sometimes come at a price.
Yeah, he's an absolute genius. And I don't know if you experienced this, but over lockdown, I know of people who obviously couldn't see people. So he would do these video calls and still be able to treat you via a video call, which is magic, to be honest. And I would, you know, if I'm, you know, financially in a good place, I would go and see him again in a heartbeat. It wouldn't be nice. I wouldn't like it, but I would see him just from a health perspective, because I know I trust him with my body, and particularly with my back. A lot of physios almost were too scared to properly go in, because it's an unknown. You don't really know what you're unraveling. Whereas he knew, and he wasn't scared to go in.
Did you ever work with Matt as well? Was he there at that time, or maybe that was a little bit later on?
I saw Matt. I think at that point Matt was under training or something within the setup. I never had treatment from him, but I knew that he was being trained under Mark or learning within the setup. And I remember thinking, "Wow, you're in a good place, mate."
Yeah. You must have been on a few. You must have been on a few teams with him and stuff as well, because you're the same age, like school age, weren't you?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, it all blows into one. But I know of him, and I'm sure we must have crossed paths quite a few times. It's a small world, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Moving on slightly from the physio, then I just wanted to touch back on. You said Chris Thompson was coaching you from around your early 20s. Obviously, Chris was one of the, maybe he was the first sponsored athlete in the UK by On. Is that right?
That is right. Yeah.
So I wondered if that had anything to do with your kind of journey towards what now working with On. Was Chris an influence there at all?
He was. Chris is such a babe. And like I say, he's my adoptive dad.
I'll tell you my Chris Thompson story in a minute after you've called me.
I've got so many Chris Thompson stories.
I don't even know him well, but I know.
Yeah. So like I said, like obviously throughout the past like 3 years, I guess, of my retirement, I've stayed in contact with Chris and Jem. I literally go around to their house and hang out and have dinner with them like an annoying 28-year-old child that just won't go away. And they feed me and they look after me and they give me life advice. And oh, it's brilliant. So we've got such a good relationship. Oh my God, what was your question, Callum?
I was basically wondering if he had any influence for you getting the job on, basically.
So, yeah. And then this summer.
You're implying she didn't get it on merit. She just got it because Tomo said she got a job. So she stopped
coming out of my house. To be fair, he did step back. It just came from. So this summer, so I retired from running. I quit and I fell into a job as a special needs assistant at a local primary school. And I went one-to-one with a boy with special needs and it was amazing. Just on a side note, we went through COVID together and that was, it was such a special journey. And actually I'm still in contact with the family now and I take him out on day trips every month or every other month to maintain that relationship because we've got such a special bond. So that was amazing for me. But it got to a point this summer where I thought, right, COVID's over. I've got that itch now. Health is good.
Dangerous words. COVID's over.
Yeah.
Come back to haunt us all.
I know. But I just felt like, you know, you get that itch and you're suddenly thinking, I'm ready. I was never going to jump into a job just because I wanted to earn more money or just to tick a box because people expected me to go on and get a certain career. I was quite stubborn and I stayed in a role for 3.5 years where I wasn't earning much money. There was no career development, but it was fulfilling in that moment. But this summer, I thought, right, my little boy, he's going to go off to secondary school soon. And I'm going to look inwards and see what gets me excited, basically. So I started looking for jobs and went for a walk with Gemma in Bushy Park. And we got talking about jobs. And I mentioned On, I'd seen a few jobs online. And she was like, Amelia, why don't you speak to Chris? And I was like, no, like, I'll do it on my own, you know, fine. And then Chris came back from his run and I don't know if you guys have ever met him, but he was like, Amelia, you just need to go for it. Like, I'll step back, but, you know, go for this job or any job, to be honest. They're such an exciting company to be a part of and just go for it. And if you want to talk about it, I'm here. So, I got in contact with Ollie Laws, who is a really close friend of Chris, but he was also head of sales at the time with On. And Ollie was like, we've got a tech rep role going. The applications have actually closed, but we'll let you in if you want to go for it. And so I went for it. And as Callum knows, we went through 6 interviews.
Really? Wow.
It was long.
Mental, like it was
Callum only had to have dinner with me in Kerry in a hotel in Kenya to get a job for me.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it was absolutely mental. And
pretend I was a professional videographer.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Well, you are good at that though, Callum. I've seen your photos and videos.
I'm not as good as what I pretended I was to Gavin though.
I didn't know any different though. It was the early days of drones, and it was like, yeah, I've got a drone. And that was it. It was like, yeah, okay, you're in.
Yeah, and speaking of whether or not you got the job on merit, part of the reason I thought I did well in my interviews and got the job at On was on my running credentials. I thought, yeah, I'm a pretty good runner. they'll love that on, you know, surely I've got the job. And then I get in and I'm chatting with Emilia Goretzka, like Steve Gibbs, who had a GB vest, Ollie Laws, who's like got some record for winning bucks the most times out of anyone.
Yeah.
And I suddenly realized, oh, okay, I'm actually not as good as I thought I was. Like the first time I went to Kenya, I went over there thinking, oh yeah, I'll enter this cross country race, probably be in the top 5 or 6. And I was like, 100.
Did you really think you'd be in the top 5 or 6?
It was a school race and I was 24. So. So I actually thought I'll do pretty well.
But, I love the enthusiasm.
Yeah, exactly. You've got to be confident, you know?
But... Exactly. And you are, Callum, like, just on a side note, like, we're working really hard at the moment. Like, we're in hotels, traveling a lot. It's been a crazy past 2 months. And in the midst of it, you're still putting together these, like, runs and sessions and stuff while I'm having a lie and going, yeah, no thanks, mate. So, like, you're still very much training hard and working hard, which is very admirable, because Ollie, Steve and I are definitely not training as much as you.
Thanks.
That's good.
Yeah, so what were we saying? Back to Tomo.
Yeah, so like he just gave me the nudge basically to apply, because I was umming and ahhing and maybe slightly hesitant, and he was like, Emilia, like, just go for it. Got me in touch with Ollie, and Ollie was like, yeah, this role's closed, but we'll let you in. 6 interviews later, yeah. And quite a long time later, I got it. I think probably at a similar time as you, Callum. I'm not sure if we were
around the same time, probably.
Yeah, but it was mental. And I kept Chris in the loop throughout. I said, you know, I'm at this stage now. And he was like, oh, so exciting.
He's now doing lots of like shoe and kit testing over in the headquarters in Zurich. Is that right?
Yeah, he's working alongside on, I think, in many capacities, to be honest. Like I said, he was their first sponsored UK athlete. So he's a valued member of the team. And I'm sure he'll be, you know, a colleague in the future at some point as well. So at the moment, he's still running, obviously.
Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know the exact details of this, so I don't want to say anything that's incorrect. But my understanding is that ON's athlete sponsorship program is actually really quite good and quite unique in that I think once a sponsored athlete who finishes their career is kind of offered the opportunity to then develop their career at ON. So if they want to work with the brand, they can do, and they're kind of provided a pathway into the brand.
Yeah.
To continue working. So I just think that's an amazing way of looking after the athletes.
Yeah.
From ON's point of view.
And I think obviously, you know the brand well, Callum, now as well, but they look for character, and that's why the interview process was so long. It wasn't just, you know, let's look at your experience. They want to invest in the right character and the fit for the brand. So actually it was a lot of character checking interviews. And once they've found somebody...
I was just going to say, I don't know.
You did pass. You must have done. And that's what they invest in above anything else. So that would be the same with whether you're an employee or an athlete. It's not just your credentials, that they're looking for more than that. They're a very holistic brand. And you've got to be the right fit to fit the ethos of the company and where they're looking to go. So, yeah, it's an exciting place to be. And I'm very grateful for the nudge that I was given.
So I'm going to let you keep talking about ON, because this is an interesting conversation. So, like, yeah, at the risk of this turning into like an advertorial for ON, which is fine, I guess. Where are they trying to go? Like, to me as an outsider who doesn't know much about the company, and to balance out you saying all this positive stuff about ON, when Tomo first got sponsored by ON, I remember thinking, God, how desperate must someone be to need to be sponsored by ON?
Yep. And people, and he would say that people laughed.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So as an outsider, and as, yeah, I guess I wouldn't say I laughed, but yeah, I thought, bloody hell, Tommy must be desperate for money. and they've completely won me round, and I completely take them seriously as a performance brand now. But yeah, like where are they trying to go, and kind of what are they doing to kind of win people over? Because it is a difficult sell, because they're coming in and doing something clearly very different, just in terms of like the actual technology, they're doing something very different.
Definitely. I mean, Cal, do you want to start?
Yeah, I was just going to say, Gap, it's basically mine and Amelia's job is basically to answer the question you just asked. Yeah. So, and now we have to say it live on a podcast. But no,
pressure.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we can. If you get it wrong, we can re-record it. So that's the great thing.
No one will ever know. Well, we've actually, as you know, Gavin, we've just, myself and Amelia have been out in Zurich at the headquarters last week. It was for the global sales meeting, so we get to see all the new products coming out and stuff like that, and kind of a bit of strategy on how we're taking it to market and things like that. But it was, for me and Amelia, I guess it was our first meeting like that, so we get to kind of meet all the heads and the head of sales, and well, that's Holly. But for us, it was super interesting because we got to see exactly that, where the brand's going and what they're trying to do to win people over, essentially. And a huge part of what we were told by the higher ups was that On really is trying to establish itself as a performance running brand. So obviously they're doing pretty well. Kind of, they're a fashionable brand. They look good. People want to buy them. People are interested in them from a fashion point of view. But now, the number one priority for On is to establish itself in the performance aspect. So obviously in the last couple of years, you've seen OAC, the On Athletics Club, get pretty big. Ollie Hoare won the Commonwealth Games. Gustav Iden just won the World Ironman Championships. So they are doing really well with the elite athlete side of things. And I think we'll probably see almost a trickle down effect from those bigger names doing well in the elite end of On products. You see Kipchoge running a sub-2-hour marathon in Nike products. People suddenly believe in that product a lot more because someone super elite has done something amazing in that shoe.
It's definitely working. The way you said, the trickle down effect is definitely working, because for me, I didn't take them seriously until I could see a good number of elite runners wearing them. This is how bad, that's not the right word for it, this is how much of a challenge they had. I didn't even used to believe that someone like Tomo would even be training in the shoes. I was like, yay. When there's a photographer there, he'll put them on, but he'll never actually run in those cloud things.
Yeah. The interesting point is that when Chris was sponsored by them initially, I was still being coached by him. And to answer your question, he very much did wear the shoes. Mm. And not only that, he would feed back to the team constantly with what his thoughts were. So they were always evolving. And if anyone knows Tomo, they'll know that he likes to talk. And he was great at that, though. He always feeds back to the team and evolved. I think it was the Cloud Flow, the concepts behind that, from the very early days. So they do work closely with their athletes, and they are very much tech driven and constantly evolving.
I'm not surprised to hear that, because I say it's been, for me personally, though, it's been then since seeing a wider range of elite athletes, and particularly since the development of OAC, and seeing those guys and girls training in training and racing in those shoes. And I've still never even put an On shoe on my foot, but I'm now at the stage, I'm not against it. For a long time, I was like, well, I'm never going to try that.
Just Callum can change that. Go on, Callum, get him some shoes.
I got Lauren some shoes, didn't I?
Yeah. No, she loves them. Yeah, she's enjoying them. Presumably then you two know a little bit about, not just about then what the company are trying to achieve, but in terms of the actual tech, I still don't understand why or how that works, or why, let's just say I need a new pair of running shoes. You think I should try On. I think I should stick with something more traditional. Why should I try these this cloud technology? Because to me, it just still looks so different from what I'm used to that I'm scared that a change that dramatic is going to cause problems.
Amelia's putting this down as a day's work now.
Yeah, I'm going to start putting in some extra hours. It's good, though. It's good practice. This is literally our job, though, isn't it, Cal?
Yeah, exactly. Go on, Amelia.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, we can break down the cloud tech initially and then explain why it's unique. So cloud tech is made up of two concepts. Obviously, you've got the traditional cloud elements, which are those lovely little white circles that you see at the bottom of the shoe. That's made up of different foam, and it compresses horizontally and vertically when you land. So the shoe is quite individual. So when you land on it, the shoe adapts to how you strike the ground. The second concept of cloud tech is every shoe, apart from one, has a speed board in it. And the different shape and torsion of that speed board will give you a different type of energy return, essentially. So we tweak the clouds and the speed board to give you different types of cushioning and energy return from the ground. And it's very individual to how you hit the ground. Correct me if I'm wrong, Callum. So
yeah, I think that's pretty much it. I think the number one difference between the majority of On shoes and other shoes is that the cushioning is almost provided from the geometry of the cloud. We call it the cloud elements. So they're like, yeah, the bits you see on the bottom that look like clouds.
Yeah,
it's provided by the geometry of those elements rather than the kind of the foam itself, so that you see the cloud elements actually physically compressing. So it's almost acting in the way that a traditional EVA foam would do, but we can create that same effect, or arguably a better effect, by removing material rather than adding extra material, which also creates an extremely light shoe. So for example, I've been doing the majority of my running in the Cloud Monster, which is, you've got pretty, well, it's currently our highest cushion shoe and highest amount of energy return in a shoe, which looks like it should be a fairly weighty shoe just because you've got so much stack height in that shoe, but it's not as super light. So I've been doing everything from my easy long runs right the way down to like faster tempo work because the shoe's so light, basically. Gavin, like I'm to be honest, I'm like, I now work for On, and I'm with you, like going back 4 or 5 years, you know, I don't want to say I didn't take them seriously, but like they were new to the scene, and it looked like they were kind of doing something different for the sake of it.
Yeah, exactly. That's how I felt. It was changed. To do something different.
Exactly. But being kind of now, well, seeing the actual developers and the products and where it's all made, like that there's some serious science that's gone into this, and like the science is compelling, to be honest with you. It's really interested in it, and it has captivated me. And I think over the next couple of years we're gonna see some even better products and stuff. But anyway, I don't want to keep you too long, Amelia. We're coming up for an hour now, and I just really,
That's all right.
Yeah, I kind of quickly want to backtrack a little bit now. We've kind of spoken about your when you stopped running, and then what happened after that, getting into your career at On and working as a special needs assistant. Yeah. I'd like to just almost rewind back to the beginning a little bit, and obviously we're a running podcast and people love to hear about running. I'd love to hear a little bit about your training as a junior athlete, and when you realized you were talented and this was a kind of a career you wanted to pursue rather than just being like something fun you did at an athletics club.
Good question. So I'm probably well known for being with Aldershot, Farnham and District. That wasn't my first club. My first club was at Dorking, which is just down the road, which is, you know, a lovely setup. But I moved on quite quickly from there just because I wanted a bigger group to train with. I was enjoying my running and I just wanted a bit more people my age to run with, basically. So I moved to Aldershot in 2006, and I was, I can't remember how old I was then, 11, 12. And literally within the next few months, I started winning things. So it escalated quite quickly. And when I say winning, it went, you know, in early 2007, the Southerns, the Nationals, the Intercounties, which I would call the triple when you get all three. Yeah. And
cross country is this?
Cross country, yeah. Because I joined, I think, the autumn or the summer before. So if you think about it, I only had about 5 to 6 months and I started winning domestically, which was great. And I was part of a club system. And you don't really think much outside of it in terms of a career. I had, obviously, around me is Steph Twells, your Charlie Purdue's, your Emma Pallant's, who were about 4 to 5 years older than me and were also doing well. But because I was part of the same club as them and we were all kind of breeding similar success stories, I never thought of it as a career until a bit older. Although I was successful as a under 13 athlete and under 15, it wasn't until I remember exactly where I was on a plane next to Steph Twell, and we were just talking very casually about our Nike contracts. And I said to her, I've got some like these numbers on my contract. What does that mean? And she was like, oh, it means that you can earn that money if you run X time. So I went home and looked at this contract and I thought, oh my God, I've earned $3,000. I didn't know. I was like, what the? And that's when it suddenly hit me that actually this could be a career and it could go somewhere. Up until that point, I was aware of my success on the domestic scene and I'd had a few international experiences running for England, but it didn't really hit me. I was very much living in the moment, which is the best way it should be, and it's what children are very good at. It's not looking too far ahead. And I didn't really think much of it until I had that conversation with Steph on the plane where I realized I could earn money. So I can't think of a moment where I realized my potential because I was just going from race to race, enjoying it.
Yeah, that's quite nice. So how old were you, sorry, when you realized that you were able to earn some decent money from this?
16. Yeah.
16, yeah. Okay. So that, yeah, $3,000 at 16. Nice. That's, yeah, big pocket money.
Yeah. It was like, oh, wow. I was like, I don't need to do a paper round or anything.
Yeah, exactly. Could you potentially share a little bit more info on that Nike contract then? How, like, for someone who's, anyone listening who, you know, doesn't know how that works, do they
yeah, approach? I mean, I think there'll probably be almost no one listening who understands how has any kind of insight into how the sport works at a professional level, is it?
Yeah, so my initial contract was a junior one. So it was, I didn't have a base retainer, which is what you'd get paid annually. I had bonuses, time bonuses and competition bonuses.
You do it for the kit at that age, though, don't you? It's like, oh my God.
It was awesome. Actually, yeah, I mean, the side story is my first kit drop. I got all this kit and I was very grateful and excited. And I was about 15, 16. And I remember emailing the Nike rep saying, you know, thank you so much for all my kit. I've chosen what I wanted. And where do I send the other stuff back? And they were like, I mean, you just keep it. Oh my God, that was groundbreaking. and to this day, I mean, I've still got a lot of Nike kit. And the amount you get is unreal. It's quite overwhelming. My poor family have constantly had to deal with all these big boxes and I've got a tiny little bedroom and it is really cool. And particularly when you're a teenager getting all this free kit, it's very helpful. But within that period, I also got a contract and they had these bonuses on them. And as a junior, they're more time bonuses and how you're doing competitions. And then as you get a little bit older, you can get something called the base retainer, which is like an annual amount. And then on top of that, you get your bonuses again. So they would be like, you know, British championships, top eight at the European championships. And you sit down with the Nike rep and you discuss this before you sign the contract and agree. And something that was in the contract that I wasn't aware of, because again, I was very much living the moment, quite young and not really focusing on potential repercussions of having a contract, is that in the Nike contract, you have written in these clauses where you can get money cut and taken away. So I was shocked at the age of 21, where I had my first stress fracture, and written in the contract was, you know, if you don't compete in the Olympics, you'll get 50% reduction in your annual base retainer, which suddenly hurts quite a lot financially.
That's a huge claw. That's a huge sort of barrier to entry just to keep your base salary. It's almost not a base salary, is it?
Yeah, it was really interesting. And again, I was lucky. I had savings and I have a supportive family, but it was just a big reality check because I'd never looked at that part of the contract. Like I said, I very much live in the moment, enjoying what I was doing, had my first ever injury. Didn't think there'd be many repercussions from that because up until that point, I'd been quite a solid ambassador for the brand. But they obviously chose to take that cut, which they're entitled to do because I've signed the contract. And suddenly I've got 50% of my annual income taken away. And yeah, it was a big learning curve. And I know that brands now are moving slightly away from that because it's not always sustainable. You can't expect somebody to be on top form all the time. You've got to give them a bit of breathing space with their body. They're not machines.
The crazy thing about that as well is I would be, not necessarily for you specifically, but I'd be willing to bet money that they somewhere in the world have got more than three people in the same country in the same event on that same deal.
So
going into Olympic year, they know full well that it's guaranteed that someone isn't getting their full money because they can't make the team.
Yeah. And at that point, Nike were sponsoring a lot of athletes. I was in a pool and an era where I think they went for quantity, and a lot of younger athletes were being sponsored at the time. I think they've very much changed that tactic now and they're homing down on who they sponsor and being a bit more selective. But yeah, they had loads of athletes at the time. But on a personal note, let's say for argument's sake, 10 grand was taken away from me. That's massive for a 21-year-old. It is not much for the brand, but it was massive for me. And
did you have a representative or were you doing negotiations yourself?
Interesting point. So for a long time I sat with those negotiations with my coach at the time, Mick Woods.
Yeah.
And we would talk them through, and again I was quite young and naive, and I really genuinely wasn't aware that that was a clause in the contract until it was brought up. And I did have an agent eventually, but I didn't feel the need to have one for a very long time.
Yeah, sure. So, it feels like that's the kind of thing. Well, that's the kind of thing that an agent would never have let you sign without knowing about in the first place.
Yeah,
100%. But it also feels that that's a big enough deal that it should have been pointed out to you explicitly.
100%. Yeah, definitely. And I mean, hindsight's brilliant, isn't it? And everyone does the best with the information they have at the time.
Sure.
And there's no, like I've said way earlier on in the conversation, there's definitely no regrets there. It's just, it is what it is. A big learning curve for me, and it just wasn't picked up on. And I was fortunate enough to have I had a good few years before that. I mean, in 2014 I ran my 15:07. I was British champ, and I earned money within that year, so I was okay. It was just a reality check of this is the world I'm in. It's not always safe, and actually I've got to protect myself.
Callum knows what it's like to have his money cut by 50%.
Do you?
Well, that's because we didn't have any camps for 2 years, thanks to COVID. So,
we agreed to take a voluntary 50% pay cut through COVID, which thankfully kept us alive, which was
tough times.
Yeah, we had to be frugal.
Yeah.
So, Amelia, we won't keep you too much longer because
right.
We really appreciate this. It's been fantastic. But yeah, let's keep talking running in a bit more, I don't know, I wouldn't say it's a quick fire round, but some questions that might be interesting to people. What do you think is your best ever performance?
I would say,
there's so many to choose from.
No, do you know what? It depends what angle you're coming at it at.
Okay, let's do two. The one that you think is objectively the highest level, and the one that you are most proud of.
Yeah, this is the split I was going for. So the one that I'm most proud of is when I won Liverpool Cross in 2017. I had taken some time out from the sport with my stress fractures. I had changed coaches and been incredibly patient in the lead up to that race, and there was no expectations whatsoever I think looking back in hindsight, I was in amazing shape and I had no idea. I was under Chris and Gemma at the time and I trained a lot on my own. So I had nothing to compare myself against. And I generally was shocked when I won that. And I don't think Chris will mind, but we both cried a little bit because we have like a really good bond and it was such a special moment for us. And it wasn't just that moment. It was like the perseverance from the patience from 2015 and all of the changes that I'd made, the financial cuts. And again, just sticking to my gut instinct with my setup and all of those changes rather than forcing a comeback and perhaps getting it wrong. So that was a really like amazing and emotional moment for me. And then from that, I went on to become captain of the Great Britain team at the European Cross, which was a brilliant moment for me. Objectively, I am really proud of my 15:07 at the age of 20. I think Paula Radcliffe tweeted at the time that was the fastest in the world, right, of a 20-year-old. Because it was a bit weird that I ran, a bit abnormal. I didn't mean to run that quick. I just jumped on the back of a train with Sifan Hassan. Yes. And I was doing my exams out in California. I'd completely winged the trip, paid for it all myself, planned it all myself, was living in a hotel room in Stanford and just rocked up and ran 15:07. It was so random, but pretty cool.
You weren't far behind Sifan Hassan, were you?
No, she just got me in the last lap, but I'm pretty sure that's the same for most people with her. I didn't have a kick at all, but I was just literally maxing out the whole way round, but felt pretty good doing it. And my brother came out to watch me do that race because he was in Portland at the time. And he was just watching me thinking, oh my God, slow down. Like, what are you doing? And I just was, again, living in the moment.
Is it a running family or are you the odd runner?
We are actually running family. My brother ran, my older brother went to Birmingham Uni under Bud Baldaro, yeah, and then went to Portland and ran out there. And my little brother actually didn't run at all while Josh and I was running. But as soon as I stopped, it's almost like he became the runner of the family. And now he's doing London Marathon. So I have to get him a pair of Ons to help him, obviously. And it's just funny how, yeah, he's now gotten into the sport and I'm questioning whether I can keep up with him. And I don't run with him at all because he's way quicker than me now. So it's funny.
What sort of times are your brothers running then?
Which brother?
The one going into the marathon. What's he aiming for?
I think he's aiming just to do it. Like he's 21, so he's pretty young, and he just goes out for like random half marathon runs, enters a race without training for it. Very much coming at it from a just want to achieve it kind of angle, which is really cool, and I love that side of things. I think obviously because I've come from that elite background where you've got a training plan and you need to think about your energy gels and how you're going to attack this race. He's very much free flowing. Like I just want to experience a marathon, and that's really cool. And probably something that I might consider doing someday if I get back up to running more than twice a week.
Yeah. Right. So, I want to just kind of finish with one last question. And I already know the answer to this because I've heard like a million people ask you it and I've probably asked you it myself.
Yeah. Is it going to be, can I have the autograph?
Is it? Can I have your autograph? Are we going to see a comeback?
No. it's not a no, is it? It's a never say never. But like I've said before, I don't miss it in that way. There isn't an itch to get back into that kind of training. The only thing that I do miss is actually just being fairly fit and been able to smash a tempo. That was a nice feeling at one point. But no, like I'm enjoying where I'm at. I have no like long-term plans. I do want to get back into running in a sense of get a bit fitter, jump into some fun races maybe. I was speaking to Steve Callum, our boss, the other day, and I was just saying the only way I think I'm going to run a bit more is just to enter a marathon, because you can't do a marathon without much training. Like you've got to do something. Whereas I've done half marathons. I did a trail half marathon last year without any training and I got away with it, because I think you can, if you've got that background. I can just jump into those kind of races. So I want to get back into a bit more training, fun runs, do some like all that crew running that I'll probably be doing with the job now, and see where that goes. But on an elite level, no. I'm very happy with where I'm at right now.
No, I think that's fantastic. Yeah, it's a great place to leave it. And it's a great place for you to be. And yeah, thank you for being so candid about it all and just sharing your experiences.
That's all right. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, no, it's been awesome. Don't know, Callum, anything to say to wrap up?
No, I think that's it. Yeah, just thanks very much for joining us, and I will take an autograph when I see you next, to be honest.
Callum, you know you don't want an autograph from me. You know me too well now. Like, you know I'm annoying.
So what we will end on then, speaking of autographs and famous people and all that, I did see a picture, Amelia, of you with Mr. Roger Federer.
Oh my God, that was amazing. And I'm really sorry. So basically, we were in Zurich for the global sales meet and we didn't know he was there at all. Poor Callum was trying to fit in his training around this global sales meet, which is really hard because you've got 8 a.m. starts to like 10 p.m. finishes. And he went out during his lunch break to do this run. And that happened to be the time where Roger was just hanging outside the building. So I got a picture and sent it to him. And I was like, ha ha, I see Roger.
Come back and everyone's Instagram story is a photo of them with Roger Federer.
You know, yours is you on a treadmill.
Yeah, exactly.
You were dedicated, but honestly, I had a little sweat moustache. I was so excited.
The first thing she said to me was, oh, just annoyed I didn't smell him.
I was annoyed because I do wonder. He had lovely skin, I have to say. I was like, oh my God, you've moisturised today. But yeah, I didn't grab him. I didn't do anything that crazy. I'm going to hug you. I stood next to him, but I wish I got a sniff. I just wish. I bet he smelled good.
Yeah, he does look like he smells nice.
Oh yeah, good times. Well, but you're dedicated, Callum. Like, don't, you know, I'm impressed with your dedication to the running, and you'll meet him eventually.
Right,
something to aspire to.
Yeah, something to aspire to. Thank you so much, Amelia.
It's all right.
See you probably tomorrow.
I'll speak to you way too soon.
Yeah.
And right. Nice to meet you, Gav.
Yeah, thank you, Amelia.
Thanks for listening to Conversations About Running, the podcast from Running Trips. We host training camps for runners of all levels, and our camps include Kenya experience in Attend Kenya and training focus camps in Loughborough. If you would like more information on any of our camps, to hear more from Callum and I, or to find other episodes of the podcast, please visit runningtrips.co.uk or find us on Insta at running_trips_official. Thanks for listening, and we hope you join us next time.